Dun dun dun.
Dun dun dun. And we're live, I think.
So it looks alive to me.
Okay, great.
And of course, there's the tape delay, so I see it here, and then I see Twitch, and yeah, we're absolutely live.
Awesome, great.
So this is so great. Well, welcome, Ryan. This
thanks,
was
John.
A fun one because we I shared on Twitter, I shared your NDC, or no, actually on the latest stand-up, one of the latest stand-ups, I shared your NDC thing, and I was like, hey, this didn't get enough attention. And then a bunch of people on Twitter are like, this is awesome. You guys should get Ryan on. And we were like, he's been on several times. Yeah. So then, and you and Damien were like, hey, why don't we do like an architect's view of ASP.NET?
Yeah. And this is going to be what I have today is a little bit similar to what I talked about at NDC. It's not going to be the same. I'm trying not to repeat stuff. When I was at NDC, that was a little bit of a split .NET Framework and .NET Core crowd. And so it was kind of suited for that audience and talking a little bit more about what is .NET Core, what is .NET Core MVC. Today, we're going to talk about some future things and some current things and some, you know, very soon things. So it'll hopefully be pretty exciting for this group.
Cool. I am just double checking here to make sure. Sometimes YouTube gets wacky and it'll create like two. Nope, that's right. Okay.
Okay.
Good. And so before we do, I'll be showing the community stand up links in a second. But so what is your official like job on the ASP?
So I have a lot of jobs. We all have a lot of jobs, right? My official job title now is Principal Software Architect. Which is a pretty recent change, but you know, I don't know. I'm not a title guy. You know, I don't think that your job title doesn't define you. You know, I'd like to think that I'm kind of everywhere, and I'm kind of adding value where I can. And sometimes that's writing code, and sometimes that's mentoring, designing, coaching, strategy, all those kind of things.
Well, and how long have you been on the ASP.NET team?
So I have been on the ASP.NET team now. Maybe 5 years. I think I joined the ASP.NET team during the MVC 5 timeframe. Mm-hmm. And I've been at Microsoft now for about 11 and a half years.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And I've done a variety of different things before this. I did profilers, I did compilers, I did, you know, a lot of developer tools kind of stuff, right?
Cool. All right. Well, I can't wait to see your presentation. So let me jump into the community links so then we can give you plenty of time.
Okay.
So here we go. First of all, this is from Mike Brind. So we've been sharing Mike's links for a long time. Mm-hmm. I love Mike's writing. So previously, like I followed, he's been an expert on like ASP.NET web pages, which was, I don't know, a very interesting product, and he was basically the expert on it. And so here he is uniquely suited to kind of talk about this, where he's saying Razor Pages is a natural successor to web forms. So, you know, with this kind of long history of, you know, Mike's worked deeply on every single ASP.NET flavor we've had available. So I like this, and this is an approach I've taken when I've talked about Razor Pages before too. I've talked about, you know, like I've talked at conferences. I remember Dev Intersection was one that came off pretty well. And I, you know, was like, look, if you are a web forms person and you just never kind of like MVC never mm-hmm. felt natural to you, take a look at Razor Pages. And I kind of, you know, I was like, this is all the goodness of MVC, but it's like as approachable as web forms.
Do you want an interesting factoid about that?
Let's hear it.
So an interesting factoid about that, when Damien and I were designing Razor Pages, my initial design concept for it didn't have on get and had on post. It had on load and on submit.
See?
And that's the lineage there is the Razor Pages optimizes for the post redirect get pattern. And I wanted to hide some of the HTTP. Damien wanted to draw it out, which is how we ended up where we are.
Yep. Yeah. Is there a button for you? Somebody saying in chat, can you full screen my screen as I'm sharing the screen?
Yeah, I would really like to do that, but I don't know what button that is. I can try a bunch of them.
Yeah, let's do it. This is,
that's my screen. There you go.
That's your screen.
Yep. I don't know what the 9, that's me.
Yeah.
They didn't tell me what that button is. Is it this one?
Just don't push one that says like end stream.
Yeah. There we go.
There, that's me.
Perfect.
That's me.
Sorry about that.
Well done. Yep. Awesome. Yeah, we've worked overtime. James Montemagno has been doing all kinds of stuff to set up to make this kind of automated. We have Stream Deck, we have all kinds of things. Oh, it auto tweets and I'm supposed to be retweeting it.
Oh.
So I should do that too. Gosh, where is it? Well, anyhow, there it is. Sorry, I just need to make sure so people know about this. Retweet and retweet. Hooray! Okay, back to where we were. Yeah, so I think this is great. You know, Mike just talking through, if you've been, you know, if you've been on web forms and MVC has never felt natural to you, this, I feel like this gives you all the goodness of MVC under the hood. It's built, you look down at the base classes and everything, it's still using MVC, but you've got kind of that natural kind of, it takes a lot of ceremony out, mm-hmm. So I think this is a great post, goes through and explains all the kind of, you know, here's how it's similar and here's how it's different. So anyhow, nice long post. And thanks, Mike, for all the great writing you do. So on and on. Okay, so here, this is cool. This is a first thing, and I believe the docs team is going to be doing more of these, but this is a interactive tutorial. Mm. Based on an ASP from the docs, there's an ASP.NET Core tutorial that has you kind of go through and build a university list, and it's using EF Core. So this is actually, as you go through, this takes you through all these things where you can sign in.
The cloud
you
have shell.
Exactly. So this is going through and doing things like, you know, teaching you about stuff like user secrets. It's teaching you kind of all the working with environment variables. So I love this. I want to see more and more of this.
This might be the one that I worked on. I've been reached out to by some people on the docs team that were doing something here. It's either this one and it's been retitled, or it's a separate like REST API tutorial. But this thing is very cool, and the Cloud Shell thing works pretty well. So you don't have to set up any environment or have anything installed on your machine to play with this.
Exactly. Yep. And this is something we've all been kind of, if you've got ideas as you're watching, if you want to send them to us in chat or tweet them to us or whatever, the docs team is very interested in this. We're all kind of excited about kind of making things approachable and interactive. And so it's not like I want to do this tutorial. Let's set aside the afternoon and, you know, clone a big repo and all, you know, make sure I've got the right Visual Studio. And like, we'd love it to be click, 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 and you're learning. So mm-hmm. Cool. All right. Pivotal. So this is from David over at Pivotal, and Glenn Condren shot this over to me. I think this is cool. This is a post from them on using Microsoft configuration extensions for mm-hmm. Steeltoe. So as you're doing configuration management, you can use environment variables, but it's difficult to kind of scale and manage that as you build up more complex systems. And you're dealing with, you know, managing, keeping different sets of configuration that are shared across multiple instances and all that kind of stuff. Steeltoe has a system for that. So, you know, here David talks about, like, you can build your own configuration server and you're going to spend a lot of time developing it and mm-hmm. doing it right. So this is really cool. This is what Steeltoe does. They have a cloud config system. And so this walks you through getting that set up and reading from those configuration variables. So we've talked a bit about this in the past. I've shared some other links on this. But this is a great walkthrough from David, you know, kind of on the Steeltoe team explaining that.
Nice.
Cool. The identity server folks just sharing this on Twitter. I'm sure a million people have said, wait, where do I find the identity server based templates in Visual Studio 2019? So here it is. If you're trying to find those, this is actually, you know, these are your steps here. Mm-hmm. It's the Angular or React and then individual authentication. So, and the magic that these are adding is using identity server to manage the authentication and make it work with Angular and React. Cool.
Quick
little Yep. Theo, this is nice. I haven't shared a code project link for a bit, so here you go. This is a custom logging provider in ASP.NET Core. So he links over to the code on GitHub, and then just a nice, detailed walkthrough of explaining building out a logging provider. Building up from the basics like the iLogger and logger provider, and then just kind of walking through how to get that set up. Good stuff. Okay, I got some exciting ones here. Shane, kicking
Ooh.
butt. Yeah, this is really neat. So what he did was he built a .NET global tool that uses the Azure CLI. So he's actually building on top of and interoperating with it. I chatted with him about this. He is using JavaScript services under the hood for some of the interaction. And this is really slick. So you can go through and you can see here in his animated GIF, you'd say .NET new web. And then you can do things like .NET Azure deploy and create, like you can actually build and create Azure instances. So this is really cool. And it's awesome that he did this the right way, like by building on top of the official Azure CLI. This gives you all the goodness. It's all tested out. It's all, all that stuff. But you can use it easily within .NET Global Tools. So very cool. This is out on GitHub, and I know he's actively working on this and building it out. I've been seeing tweets from him on updates and improving it and stuff over time. So give it a shot. Let us know. All right. Shahed, on his weekly series. This guy, man, he's written at least a book, maybe two by now, because he's just kicking out these amazing posts every week. So this is he's been doing an A through Z series, and here he's up to P for production tips. So a lot of great stuff. Production is something that I feel like a lot of time we'll kind of jump between, we'll say, here's how to build a site, here's all the basics and stuff. And then we'll skip ahead to like the DevOps stuff of like, I don't know. We don't really look at the production and deployment stuff enough sometimes. So in other words, we'll kind of pass that over and we'll say, here's the development side and here's the, maintenance of an ongoing website, but then there's some kind of like magic happens as far as actually deploying. So I like here some of the things he points out. Talks about things like deployment slots. If you're not using those, you've got to check those out on Azure. Configuration is really important. Not deploying things, making sure that your user secrets are taking advantage of Azure features. Migrations, this is another key thing, is a lot of time it's very easy when you're developing to just use migrations to just, migrate up and down, but that doesn't really work well in production. So here he talks about scripting out. So script your migrations and you can actually run those migrations in production.
You know, we just talked about this today, actually. The
Let's hear
reason
it.
why Damien is not here, by the way, is that the whole ASP.NET team is currently going through the workshop, Damien and Fowler's ASP.NET Core Applications Workshop. And we had a
Yeah,
very long
interesting.
discussion today about all the different ways that migrations can be used and the advantages and disadvantages of all of them, and how they the popular pattern of I'll just initialize my database when my website starts and all the problems with that when you try to actually put that in production. So I don't claim to be the expert of any of this, but I thought it's interesting coincidence that this hot topic was something we spent a long time on today with the team.
And it's one that people have definite strong opinions on. There's different ways of managing. Some people say, hey, I just run my migrations in production, works for me, it's fine. Other people will get very upset if you try and tell them that, and they say, no, this is DBA work, and we want to optimize our scripts and all that. So there's different ways to do it, and but definitely being able to generate SQL scripts gives you a lot of flexibility there. So yeah, great post. And then going through CI/CD. So I love the detail that Shahed's putting into these. And like I said, man, put a slap a cover on it and get someone with a big forehead to write a foreword for you, and you got a book there. All right. So now ending up with three great official posts. These are releases. So here, Daniel on the ASP.NET Core updates for .NET Core 3 Preview 4. Tons of stuff. Yeah, so, you know, talking about, you know, all the stuff, you know, I'm basically going to say go read this post, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's just tons of stuff in here and a lot of exciting things, especially with Razer and Blazor. There's gRPC. There's the Worker SDK, which we've been showing a lot lately. I don't know. Anything else stand out?
I will point out with this, if you are interested in Blazor and you haven't tried Blazor, you should give it a try. If you have already tried Blazor, there's some pretty big changes for Blazor in this release. If you are looking to use Blazor or you have been using it, I would definitely go get the VS16.1 preview 2 of 16.1 that was just released, I think, today, because we had some bad bugs in preview 1 of 16.1 that we were not able to find and fix before this release came out. So it's kind of tricky for us anytime we do things that have an impact on tooling. And all the work that we do on Razer and Blazor definitely, in fact, impacts the Razer editor. So if you are going to do Blazor, strongly encourage you check it out. If you haven't, go get that newest preview of VS.
Cool. Yep. And yeah, speaking of Blazor, here's the official, Blazor is now an official preview.
So excited about this.
Yes. And it actually has a... I forget what we call these. It's not a logo.
It's a blazing at symbol. Doesn't need a name.
So this is, I'm embarrassed because when Daniel showed this to me, I was like, oh, it's cool. And then I was like, what's the at sign? And he's like, you know, it's a Razor thing. You hit at and then you type some C# code. What's wrong with you? So yes. And then now I feel dumb. But this is very cool. I was talking to him about getting some swag printed up for this, so that's cool. And then just all the stuff about, you know, the release, what's in the preview and stuff. So yeah, congrats on this. I know you've put a ton of work into Blazor. Cool. And finally, updated Razer support in Visual Studio Code.
Yes. So
more good stuff.
Finally.
And I think next week we have Taylor on, and he's talking about some tooling stuff, and he's worked on this too, right?
Oh, that's going to be great. So shout outs to Taylor for this, because I mean, everything we do is a little bit of a team effort at the least. But Taylor's really been the one man show here with the VS Code stuff. And he's been kind of doing that by himself, and it's been a very long road to get official Razer support in VS Code with Blazor support, and it's getting better every day. And just, you know, he deserves all the kudos. It's great. He's worked very hard on this.
I'm excited to have him on. Taylor's like, he's just so great to work with. He's a great guy. I actually first met him at San Diego Code Camp. He came down and spoke at that. So, well, cool. I'm done with my links, so I will share them out. But let's go to you.
Okay.
And I need to figure out where is my, there it is. Team, stop sharing. Good.
I have gone to me.
So well done.
I actually have some cool slides here. So first, you know, promoting myself, I'm going on world tour here in a couple of weeks, which is going to be pretty exciting. I'm going to be at Dev Intersection in Orlando with Brady and Jeff Fritz. We're going to be doing the Blazor workshop there, and I'm going to be speaking on Blazor. And then I'm going to be doing the workshop again the next week in Oslo with Steve. And then I'm going to be immediately leaving the workshop to go to Spain and giving a talk on Blazor there. So it's going to be an exciting couple of weeks. If you're going to be at any of those conferences, love to meet you, love to say hi. Otherwise, let's get on with the show. So what I had hoped to talk about to you today is a little bit of the future of MVC and the future of ASP.NET, and kind of how we see, or how I see, MVC kind of changing and evolving over the next couple releases in the next couple years. So this is going to be a little bit long term, and it's going to be a little bit slow. And there's some of this stuff is coming at you and has come at you in 2.2. Some of it's going to come at you in 3.0. Some of it is going to come at you in the future. But before we dig into that, I just want to talk about what's an IOC framework. And I'm specifically referring to one use case. There may be a couple meanings of the term IOC framework. And for me, I mean, in the context of something like an MVC, you know, what is an IOC framework is, the term, by the way, I should have written it on the slide. It stands for inversion of control. And what I mean by that is that we call your method. So if I make this like do stuff method, I can put some parameters in here. And the crux of it is, it might seem kind of stupid to take this for granted, but the framework provides a way to call this method, right? And that's the whole reason why you're here. The whole reason why you're here is that MVC is a fancy system that is going to call this method in some way, right? And there's a whole bunch of things that kind of, you can't throw that, by the way. There's a whole bunch of things that go into this or sort of describe what we mean when we say that it's an IOC framework. Like, what if I have my DB context here, right? So something in the framework, I don't have one in this class or in this project, so it's not going to compile, but like the framework has got to construct this thing via DI, right? It's got to know when to do that. The framework has got to describe when this method is going to get invoked. We call that routing. The framework has got to decide what to pass in for these parameters, and we would call that model binding. And then the framework is going to decide what to do with whatever you return. We call that an action result in MVC. And then there's some kind of like implicit contracts that ride below the surface here, which are things like, how is validation handled? What's the contract of this method, right? So like, you could make this method async. That's a contract we support. But what about, you know, if you're a longtime MVC dev, you're familiar with this pattern, right? If model state is valid, then I know I'm valid, update my database. Otherwise, you know, show the view again to show the error. So there's some other contracts here that we give you, which are sort of like, well, if you're called, you might be in a valid state, you might be in a non-valid state. All of those opinions or all those things together are kind of like what we would call MVC or what we would call a controller. It's all these little decisions. What method gets called? How do we construct the class? What arguments are passed? What do we do with return value? And then any implicit contracts like error handling. So when we think about something like an MVC versus a Razor Pages, some of these things are different for MVC and Razor Pages, right? Like for Razor Pages, for instance, like we don't make you give us a return value in Razor Pages. It's one of the way that Razor Pages optimizes for a particular scenario. Is we assume that what you want to do is run a view because it's Razor Pages, that's what it does. Whereas like API controller does some things different. You have this different implicit contract about error handling. If you're in a view, you want to get called with the validation errors so you can show them with the user. If you're in an API, you want the system to give you a boilerplate response. These are the ways in which frameworks like this differ. Now, if you think about something like SignalR or gRPC, if you dug into gRPC, well, what's different about that? What's different is what method gets called, right? The method gets called based on what SignalR hub method was invoked. What arguments are passed? Well, it's using a different format to serialize that. What do we do with the return value? Well, SignalR, I think, doesn't have return values. It might. And then there are different contracts, right? SignalR has concepts like connections and different things. So think about these things as we go through and talk about some of these other kinds of concepts around MVC and around frameworks in general. So we don't call, you know, don't call us, we call you. That's what makes this different from a library. There's not a method that you call to run your controller. Your controller is a bunch of methods that we call. Now, the big implication of all of this is that in MVC, since we're calling your method, since we're providing you the parameters, since we're interpreting the return value, there's a lot more stuff for us to break. But there's also a lot more value for us to potentially provide. Because if you slice your application and you ask yourself, what percentage of the vertical of this application is my code? Well, it might be 30%, it might be 40%, depending on how you think of that. So there's a lot of things that we're doing on your behalf, which is potential for you, for us to give you a lot of value, but it's also a lot of potential for us to break your stuff. So like, if we don't model bind correctly, you probably don't have too many workarounds for that, because you didn't write that code, right? We wrote that code. If we don't call the right method, there's not too much you can do to unstick yourself from that situation unless, you know, your routing's messed up and there's a workaround. So the stakes are kind of high for all these things because it's not like a method you call, it's a method that calls you. So we have to sort of get that stuff right. So when we think about the evolution and the future of MVC, we're talking about many years and many releases because all these changes can be impactful. And if we get them wrong, they can really hurt. We're also thinking about areas that I would call O of one impact. And what I mean by that is, if you're not a computer science geek, what I mean by that is, like, let's say we're going to change how you register routing, which is a great example, because we are. So let's say we're going to change how you register routing. Like, what's the impact on your application? Do you have to go look at every line of code? Do you have to replace every usage of some API? The answer is no, right? It has O of one impact. You got to fix one section of your app one time. It would be crazy for us to do something like remove methods from controller or remove functionality from Razor, right?
So because that affects untold lines of code.
Untold lines of code, right? So like it's a good thing. It's a good thing for us if we can add a lot of value and you have to adjust a little bit in this release or in the next release. It's a really bad thing if you have to delete your code and start over, right? We never want anybody to say, I look at the changes that you made in this version and I had, my only reaction was I had to delete my code and start over. That's never a good story. So it'd be crazy to think about us doing something like that to controllers and views where we just like obsolete the API surface completely or something like that. So just to set a ground rule, I mean, when we talk about evolving, growing MVC, adding functionality, changing things, we're talking about usually things that are startup, things that are extensibility, things that are shared components that you as an application author might only really interface directly with in a few places. Examples.
So it's more like I have to turn on or off a feature or flip a switch, but yeah.
So examples of this, we have some different ways that kind of I think about this. Now I'm gonna briefly show a demo at this point, and I'm not gonna do too many of these because I did, I have a couple demos here. I'm just gonna show one in particular. I showed this as part of my NDC London talk. So if you're interested in that, you can go watch the video. I linked it on that slide. And I've got a test page. I've got a test page here. And before I run any code, I'm going to show you what we're talking about. So I have got the wrong project. I have got this bad input controller. And I have got this read awesome enum method. And I've got this pet kind enum. So I've got a method here that just takes an enum. And it's going to be a dog, a cat, or a fish, because I have decided that those are the only acceptable animal types. And now if you look at this, this is a 2.2 application, but you're gonna notice that there's a version 2.0 here, and I'm gonna explain that in a minute, so just sit tight. So on my page in my browser, I am gonna submit my favorite pet, and I'm a dog guy. I have two dogs. I have a corgi and a miscellaneous shelter dog. So I can do it, and I can say the value is dog, everything is fine. Right? Now what if your favorite pet was a cat? We can see that's also fine, right? Now something else that will work here, because these are enums and this might surprise you, is I happen to know that this is the enum value of dog, and I've got this code wired up to print the value that was submitted on the wire. So 0 was sent over the wire. Inside the controller we get dog. I'll prove that real quick. So we can go in here, I'm gonna submit this again, and you can see I've got dog here, even though the value that was submitted was 0, because these are .NET enums, right? And so a .NET enum can be converted from an integer. Did you mean that when you wrote this code that you wanted to accept integers here? I don't know. Let's try something else. So 2 would be, or 1 would be cat, right? So we have cat. And I, of course, 2 would be fish. What about 3?
3.
Are we valid? We are valid. So everything is fine. Wait, what? So in 2.0 and previous versions of MVC, I think this was 2.0 and earlier, we would accept an enum value that as long as it was convertible to any value of that enum, right? Because enums are just numbers. Mm-hmm. We'd be happy to say that that's valid. Did you intend to allow like 3 as valid input to this API?
Absolutely not.
Probably not, right? It'd be nice if we fixed that problem. but who's relying on that behavior?
Like, wait, would this be like a binary super, this would be 1 + 2, so this would be a catfish?
This is not a flag enum. This is not a flag enum, I like where your head is at. I like where your head is at. So we actually fixed this. And we did it with this compatibility version thing. I'm going to show it real quick, and then I'm going to explain it. So if I put in 3 now, this is going to give you a boilerplate like, hey, this is a validation error. The value 3 is invalid and so on, right? Cool. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to explain this compatibility switch thing. So compatibility versions are a way for us to fix these little issues without like massively death by cutting everyone in the world, right? What's the percentage chance that your application is relying on this behavior, right? I would hope it's small. But
probably low, yeah.
If the percentage chance is like 0.1%, how many ASP.NET Core applications are there? There are thousands, right?
Good point, yeah.
So somebody's going to be affected by this, whether they wanted it or not, right? So the other problem with that is like, okay, so what if you upgrade and you don't test this, because you probably don't test this, and then you find out that you were actually relying on this behavior? Then
that's a rough one too, because it's going to affect you in weird ways.
Yeah,
right?
then what do you do, right? Do you downgrade the application? Like, do you have to roll back to 2.1? So we chose to use what I'd like to call a soft hammer for these kind of things, right? So with 2.1 and newer, we ship with this compatibility version setting. And this basically allows you to, for these minor things, set what you want the expected compatibility version of the framework to be. And this is a 2.2 app, so I have 2.0, 2.1, 2.2 as my options, right? The other thing that I can do here is on MVC options, I've got all of these specific options here. So suppress binding undefined value to enum type. That's that option, right? So I could set mm-hmm. this to true, and I could fall back to that earlier behavior. I don't know if the docs show up in the ref assemblies or whatnot. Okay, the docs are here. All right, great. I've written a novel on all of these properties, and I've also written a novel on this compatibility version that explains exactly what's included in all of these. So this is kind of a practice that we identified to help make it easier to fix the framework or evolve the framework in small ways. So do
I anticipate, or is there going to be a version 3.0 of that flag too?
So there will be a version 3.0 of this flag. What there will not be is there will not be, in version 3.0, you can't set this value to 2.2. So the way I think of this is like, we apply this when we think about something that is like, we made a mistake or we had a bug and we're trying to move everybody to the best version of the framework, right?
Okay.
And what's the best way to do that? We don't really want you to show up. We don't really want you to get 2.2, which is supposed to be a minor version, and then just have all these like things hit at once that are ostensibly bug fixes. So what we're doing is instead, you can use the 2.2 libraries, which will get you a lot of new features. You can get on 2.2 ASP.NET as a platform, right? But you can run mm-hmm. in 2.1 compatibility mode for a period of time to make it easier for you to upgrade and migrate and so on. So that's one of the things that we're doing. And then the plan is to, for all of these things that have compatibility switches, they get removed in 3.0 unless we have a reason to keep it. So there have been cases where we've said, we're going to keep an old behavior as a non-default option. I don't remember what case that was just now, but there was a case where we did something and we said, basically, we have a behavior here. It's kind of valid. We're changing the default because we think that there's a better thing for everybody. But we're going to leave the old behavior here as a non-default, so you can opt into it if you want. I don't remember which setting that was offhand.
So to make sure I understand that, let's say I've got one of the like that enum binding. I that breaks my code, right?
Yeah.
So then I've set compatibility version 2.1.
Yeah.
And then when 3.0 comes out, or maybe 3.1, at some point you stop that compatibility version stops. Preserving that old bad behavior.
Yeah, and so what we do specifically for something like 3.0 is we leave the old versions in. So like this value is defined in 3.0, but it's marked obsolete.
Okay.
So you'll get a warning saying, hey, we're not going to stop your code from compiling, but we're letting you know that this doesn't do anything.
Perfect. Right? Perfect.
These settings have been removed.
Yep.
So you can think of it like sort of a delayed bug fix, right? Because it would be kind of aggressive for us for some of these kinds of things to just blast them out to everybody in the next minor release. So it's kind of like if there's something that we think is going to impact people, what we think the right behavior is to make the best behavior on by default in the next minor version, but let people choose to have that behavior. So what it really does for us is it settles the debate within the team when we look at a bug to say, what do we do when we fix this bug? Do we fix it and give you an opt-in to the new behavior? Or do we fix it and give you an opt-out from the new behavior? And the answer is, well, it's really both, right? Depending on your compatibility version.
This gives you kind of the best of both.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to drop back to, so that's compatibility versions. That's one of the things that we're doing. So examples of this would be all these minor bug fixes. If you're interested, you can go F12 on those values and you can see what they are. Some medium-sized breaks are things like we added support for validation attributes on parameters in MVC. So did you know that if you had like a string parameter in your controller with the required attribute, that didn't do anything?
Because just about anything can be coerced to a string or whatever.
I mean specifically like putting attributes on parameters in action methods.
Prior
to 2.1 didn't do anything. Oops. But that was never, that wasn't an oversight. It was never in previous versions. Like we never had that.
So that was something where you can put a parameter on an attribute anywhere. That's great, but it wasn't
something we looked at, and we never had support for that. We added that in 2.1, but we knew that adding this behavior is going to break somebody compatibility switch. And there were legitimate things that we broke when we added that feature, because it's a big impactful feature. We had to do something that we weren't doing before. So that's an example of something I would say is a medium, right? We're replacing the implementation of something with a better implementation. We know that there might be some problems with people adopting it and we want to fix them. And the way that we're going to do that is with a compatibility switch and giving you the choice, right? Cool. It's kind of like if we want to keep the framework changing and growing and evolving and we want to keep making it into the best version of solving these problems, we have to have a plan for how we continue to change and how you can manage that change and how you can sort of keep pace with what we're doing without too much impact to your plans, right? In terms of large changes are, you know, we're doing a large change in 3.0 with endpoint routing. It's a new API surface and a plan to migrate. So we can't just delete old code. We're not going to remove the old routing system from the universe, at least not in 3.0. And a migration to a new routing system has to come with migration docs. It has to come with analyzers in some cases. It has to come with guidance about if you're doing this, you now want to do this. And it has to really deliver some value. So we're gonna spend a little bit more time talking about this one, by the way.
Okay, so going back just a bit, so there's a question in chat. Yeah. Steve's saying, can you not use an enum behind the flag then in your 3.0 example? So going back to that example where there was the item 3, which didn't match up to an enum value. What happens in 3.0?
In 3.0, that will be a validation error all the time.
Okay.
Because nobody asked for us to keep that old behavior.
Right.
Okay. I mean, if you don't want that, you can use an integer.
Right. Okay. Cool.
Right. I mean, if you do really need that, speak up. Because we can do whatever you want. I mean, we can't literally do whatever you want, but our decision making on a lot of these small things is really driven by what people in the community think is valuable. Is it more surprising that enums act like a constrained set of values, or is it more surprising that an enum acts like an integer with a name, with a type name? You know, I think I'm in the former camp as far as my personal opinion. As far as what the team should do, my opinion matters a little. If people really are vocal about, I want this to be a setting and I want it to be configurable, that's what we would do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what you're explaining there is there a lot of these things, it's a judgment and a value call, and it's not a this is right and this is wrong. How does this enable the most people to not break their code and to keep build and take advantage of new features and all those things in the best way?
Yep. So another point about this is kind of, you know, my way of driving home the discussion about doing these compatibility switches and minor versions and stuff. Part of the motivation for compat switches is to avoid getting to 3.0 and having this just like wave of minor bug fixes that are all breaking changes in behavior. Because this enum thing, there may be 5 or 6 others that we could talk about, but this enum thing is a minor, it's a breaking change, right? It's going to break somebody. you know, we think that it's worth it because it's the best version of this behavior. But it's not, we don't really think that it's good enough to just delay all these things to 3.0 and then have them all hit at once and say, we fixed these 30 things that we wanted to fix and they all result in potentially breaking change. We want to roll them out gradually and slowly so that you have a little time to react to the fact that the old way is not going to be supported.
Yeah, it seems like sometimes people like to use Semver as like a, hey, sorry, we did a breaking change version, and so tough luck. You know, we're gonna kill all your apps.
Yeah, you know, I hope people expect better. To be honest, like I think you can expect better from us. I hope you expect better from us than to just say we broke your stuff. We're sorry. I mean, I think it's fair to ask us to justify why something is valuable if we're gonna break something.
Yeah. I think for me, one of the best ways that I've known that you folks do care deeply about, you know, not breaking people and all that. But when I see the discussion and the thought that goes into every single pull request and issue, you know, it's like there is a huge amount of like, hey, if people are pushing back on something and they have valid reasons, okay, let's step back and let's, you know, so I think that's really cool.
I mean, the example that I would give recently was we were doing a change. We were doing a security motivated change, privacy and security motivated change, where we were, and it's one that I can talk about because we didn't feel like it's a burning security thing. It was more of a security best practices kind of change than it is a we have a vulnerability kind of change, which is why I'm talking about it. We made a change where we're logging the values of action arguments into the log at info level. Which is against our own guidelines, right? So we tried to,
because that's in the logs.
You could pass your OIDC cookie value or your, you know, some kind of security token or something like that. If you wrote an API that passed a security token as a string, that string would end up in your logs. We tell people to use form posts and JSON things like that for security, because we will log things like query strings and URLs. But we found a leak, right? And a guy who is really passionate about this showed up in the PR and said, well, you can't just take these away. You've got to give us some other way to see these values in some log somewhere, right? So we had a little dialogue about that, and we figured out, you know, somebody had some very valuable feedback and pushed back on something that was going to be done that would regress, you know, his scenario, and we figured it out, right?
Well, and that can be a tricky case too, where it's like most of the time something that is not a security bug, but a security best practice or whatever, that can get in the way of you're actually debugging an OIDC login issue or right?
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, I mean, I don't think I need to spend too long talking about why we want to change and why we want to grow and why we want to evolve frameworks. I think the biggest one here is this third one, which is, sometimes your requirements change, right? So what were the requirements when we shipped ASP.NET Core 1.0? I would say that the requirements when we shipped ASP.NET Core 1.0 were, let's give people who are used to MVC 5 and Web API 2 a landing pad for .NET Core. Let's give people a really similar, a place to call home if you're an MVC developer. What are the requirements now? Well, the team owns three or four different frameworks that we ship. We ship controllers, we ship Razor Pages, we ship gRPC in combination with the Google folks. We ship Blazor, other people are shipping other frameworks. There's Giraffe, there's Nancy. So the requirements are a little bit different now when you think about some of the things about how MVC works. It's a little bit of a different landscape. If you're gonna be coupled to anything, be coupled to your requirements, but sometimes your requirements change. That's the best motivation. So finally, let's talk about new stuff. I think the future of MVC is that the future is a little flatter, right? And by that I mean right now you've got all these app concerns. We talked about IOC, right? And we talked about the things that instantiate your controller and the thing that route to your action and the thing that sets your parameters and the thing that processes your return values. And all these decisions are sort of stacked up inside MVC right now, right? Authorization is another big one. What's the way that you do authorization in our stack? Well, right now you do MVC to do authorization, or you do SignalR to do authorization. So I think the future is flatter because we're shipping more frameworks, and third-party people in the community are shipping more frameworks as well. So like, can we squish the amount of layers and pull some things out of MVC and say these are ASP.NET features now, not MVC features? I think the future is more sharing, and the future is more sort of portability. Like, can model binders work between all of the frameworks that we have? Can we make a model binder be a thing that you call from code? That your same model binder works in MVC and works in SignalR and works in all these different places? I think that the future is also thinking about controllers and Razor pages a little bit as different things. And I don't want to scare anybody with that. I know somebody out there is scared. It might be you, John. Somebody out there is scared. So I don't want to scare you. That's why I have that line there with an asterisk. We want to optimize Razor pages for HTML. We're not going to turn Razor pages into an API framework. I think we'll always keep sort of MVC Classic, which is using controllers to serve views. But I think we do want to specialize controllers a little bit more for APIs. And I think we do want to maybe think about MVC and our controllers and Razor pages as being their own things that are part of the ASP.NET Core Galaxy instead of controllers and Razor pages being one thing together.
So I can see both sides of this, because on the one hand, yeah, that does make sense. And sometimes they like, if I'm building an API, I'm not concerned about all the other stuff that goes on with an HTML request, response and all that. On the other hand, didn't we just move from, we had API controllers and MVC controllers and we mashed them together, and now we're taking them apart? What's going on?
We didn't take them apart. Okay. So we did API controller. I mean, if you've seen it, we did API controller in 2.1, and it's an attribute. It's not a different base class. So to reemphasize, I guess, maybe a more positive way to think about this, or kind of how I think about this, would be that if we do the first part, which is we're going to squish things down to lower layers of the framework. So ASP.NET is going to have formatters. ASP.NET is going to have model binding. ASP.NET is going to have authorization. Then all those things are shared components that are used by whatever. So saying that Razor pages and controllers are part of the same framework is still true, because they're all still part of ASP.NET. So maybe I'm being a little nebulous here, but I guess what I want to say is, I think that there's value in us thinking about how things that we have today can be used in new scenarios, and what kind of interesting capabilities that's going to open up for people. So I want to do a couple more slides real quick, and then we're going to talk about code. Because I don't want to spend too long on slideware.
Sure. And I apologize for all the questions.
Oh, no, it's great. It's great. How do we get there? So most things in MVC can be customized per action. So most of the customization that you have is attributes on a method, attributes on a class. That means that you're doing customization per action. Routing is the engine that decides what action you get to. So if we want to try and get to this vision of having MVC's features sort of be democratized for you to use and mix up in lots of various ways, then we got to think about routing first, because that is ultimately your customization engine. How is routing today? Routing today is a feature that is probably only really used by MVC. So it's probably only really used by controllers and Razor pages. You can technically use routing for other things, but we mostly think about it as being used by controllers and Razor pages. When you get inside of MVC, that's kind of where all the magic happens. So MVC has got the primitives for how you actually decide an action. Routing alone today can't really do it. So I'm gonna show that real quick, and I've just got this open to show some code. What sort of makes MVC different from like a middleware is, in middleware, you have a signature that's like a HTTP context of task kind of method. Mm-hmm. So the way that this works is, we have a routing middleware. Actually, I have a diagram. I'm just going to look at the diagram. This is how it works. So the way that this works is, you have the middleware pipeline. You get to use MVC. Use MVC is actually the routing middleware. right? You pull off the mask. Underneath, it's the routing middleware. The routing middleware is going to call into MVC. It's going to call into this guy. This guy has got the list of action descriptors. An action descriptor sort of statically identifies what an action is. Mm-hmm. And then it's going to call into an action invoker. An action invoker is a thing that's kind of like a middleware, and it runs your code. So everything that you see, oops, that is the wrong thing. Everything that you see, or everything that we talked about in terms of what is an IOC framework, is all inside of that action invoker. So model binding, creating the class, interpreting the result, filters, authorization, cores, all these features are all inside that bucket, right? They're all sort of behind this wall right now.
Yep.
And MVC is the only thing that's really got the smarts to select an action or define an action right now.
So, and which is part of like when I look at Razor pages or whatever, everything's, yeah. It's all MVC classes under the hood and namespaces and stuff, right?
And that's why it is. The other point about Razor pages is what's different between Razor pages and a controller? Well, Razor pages is a different kind of action descriptor. So if I'm looking at the MVC code, by the way. So if I bring up controller action descriptor, that's a type that we have. So it's a kind of action. And if I bring up page action descriptor, that's a kind of action, right? So we specialize what type of action descriptor they are, and they define different things. And then they also, no surprise, define different action invokers because they kind of work in different ways. So you could, if you wanted to, use MVC to implement your own kind of framework on top of, but we didn't end up doing that. for even our own stuff, because we feel like it feels wrong, right? So you kind of got this extensibility system for frameworks to plug into, but only really controllers and Razor pages are plugged into it. So enter endpoint routing, and I'm gonna go to code because I feel like I've been doing too many slides and it makes me sad. So let's go to some code. Endpoint routing is a new routing system that we're introducing in this release. It's kind of been in the background in 2.2, and you may or may not have had success with it.
My understanding with like the 2.2 was like, hey, we're making it available, but the framework's mostly using it. You're not using it.
Yeah, we added it as an implementation detail. Mm-hmm. The thing that I want to say about it is that we got some things wrong when we did that in 2.2. And there's a big set of users. I say it's a big set because in terms of the things that people are giving feedback and saying this isn't working for me about, it's a pretty big set to me. It's bigger than I'd like. There's a big set of scenarios that didn't work super well for this in 2.2. I am working on making that better in 3.0, and I would expect that to be better for just about everybody in 3.0. So if you tried this in 2.2 and you had to turn it off for whatever reason, I'd like to hear from you if you're not happy with the state of things in 3.0, because we're trying to address everybody's scenarios for this in 3.0. So more will be coming around this. But the big thing that people have run into is URL generation not working the same way. That was an intentional choice in 2.2. We have reverted that. It will work the same way, pretty much exactly the same way in 3.0 for you. So if you haven't seen this, this is a 3.0 startup class. And something that's different here that will jump out right away is you've got this add controllers with views, and you've got this add Razor pages. So what's that about? So we're introducing some different opinionated add services methods that are focused around different ways that people use stuff. So one of the things, what sort of got us on this path is we've had a lot of requests for this. We've had a lot of people request specifically, I want to have controllers and I don't want to have views. I specifically don't want to have views.
For the case where you just want really tight APIs and...
Yeah. Okay. And so we try to make everything as pay for play as possible in the framework. But we have heard from a lot of people that it feels bad to them to have the full MVC stack available, and they want to be sure that they're not paying for anything that they're not using.
Now, is there a reason not to have add controllers without views? Because in the past, we've always assumed views are included, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we could call it add controllers without views. I mean, it doesn't exactly roll.
I mean,
it doesn't exactly roll off the tongue.
Right. What I'm saying is, it's the assumption that when I add controllers, am I getting, I guess, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
I'm thinking about, am I assuming I'm getting views or not when I'm adding controllers?
Yeah, so I would say, I mean, obviously, we're not removing AdMVC, so like...
Yeah, you're right.
AdMVC is still here. If you're happy with this and you don't see any reason to change, don't change.
And that's obvious that I'm getting views with MVC. Yeah,
add controllers with views obviously gives you controllers and views. I mean...
So then what's the difference between add MVC and add controllers with views?
Add MVC, the difference between add MVC and add controllers with views is Razor Pages.
Oh, right. Okay.
So add controllers with views is give me, this is basically the equivalent to like the 1011 MVC. So it's kind of everything but Razor Pages.
Mm-hmm.
This is Razor Pages and view stuff. This is the API optimized profile. So,
and one other thing with this, what's the difference between add controllers with views and Razor Pages and add MVC?
Add controllers with views is going to, so add controllers with views is MVC minus Razor Pages.
So if I take those lines 36 and 37, is that basically add MVC?
Yes.
Okay.
So it will compose. So you can do all these things. I mean, you could do this and it would be the same, right?
Okay.
So what we're doing, what we're experimenting with in previews, and we want feedback on this, by the way, what we're experimenting with in previews is we have templates that specialize. We have like a Razor Pages template. We have an MVC with views template, and we have an API template. Those are the three templates we have today that include MVC, right? So you'll find one of each of these things in those templates now. And we want people's feedback if it's the right set of stuff that are included, because we've definitely gotten a lot of feedback from people on the API focused side of the house that they're looking for an API focused thing. So we want to provide that. We have heard less feedback from people that say, I am interested in a Razor Pages focused thing, or I am interested in a controllers and views focused thing. So since previews, we have created these, and if the feedback is extraordinarily negative, or the feedback is these are confusing, then maybe we don't ship them.
Cool, makes sense. And those are all, like, if I looked at those are just doing a bunch of things that I could do myself, right? You're pulling together a bunch of things.
I mean, they register a bunch of services. So we've previously done this other thing here. We have this add MVC core.
Right.
And this is something that we didn't really promote to people. So we added this in 1.0. And we didn't really promote this because, in general, when people have engaged with it, they have found it really confusing. The other thing that I would say is kind of a mistake here is that things like this are a mistake. So if you try to use add MVC core and you don't have add authorize attribute, like the goggles, they do nothing. Like it's just no ops, right?
So which is like, terrible.
That's
right?
A big mistake. So there are some. We tried to do this pretty early in the product cycle, and I wish we hadn't shipped it. It has some razor sharp edges, and it's got its like loyal following. Some people like it because they like having that level of control. I think these things are more about like we're gonna try and find some balance here with what these options are like and more curated than just giving you MVC Core Builder and saying like, here's a box of Legos, have fun.
Right, okay.
So I wanna talk about routing real quick. So this is your 3.0 template, and I've kind of like removed some comments and stuff. And I have got a couple middleware here. And what is probably gonna, ignore what's commented out here for right now.
Yeah, I'm sure that's not interesting.
It's not. No, it will become interesting. You've got this routing middleware, and then you've got some stuff in between, and then you've got use endpoints, which is where things are wired up. So this is, you can kind of think of this as the replacement for use MVC. Now what's cool about this use endpoints is that you are also going to see all this other stuff in it. So you're going to see Blazor in here. You're going to see a bunch of specialized things for like spas. You're going to see health checks in here. You're going to see the ability to wire up delegates in here. You're going to see Signalar in here, if you have a Signalar hub. And it's really the reach of routing is much broader now. There's one framework, one routing system for all these different things that we're shipping. I don't have gRPC in this project, but if I did, gRPC would be wired up as well in here. And so this, the routing system is now in 3.0 is shared between all of these different frameworks. So I want to highlight then now what's in the commented out box. And I'm just going to run this and we're going to hit this and we can look at it and talk about it. So notice again that I've got these lines here. I've got authentication and authorization inside my routing system. Mm-hmm. And so I get in here and I see I've got an endpoint. Now an endpoint is this like new primitive, right? You can think of an endpoint as like an action descriptor for everything. Is this might be a little too small. But I've got my display name here and I've hit, this is an MVC app. I've hit the home controller index. If you can see the tiny text inside this tooltip, right? Yep. And I've got a request delegate. A request delegate is a middleware. I can see that I've got a route, right? That's this route that I wrote right here. Mm-hmm. And you can see that I've got all this stuff on this endpoint.
This basically, that gives me, like, I've debugged stuff where I'm like stepping into the MVC source to figure out why is something not binding or whatever. Yeah. This exposes that to me.
Yeah. I mean, not for model binding, but for routing, well, yes.
Yeah, routing, exactly. Yeah. Sorry.
The other thing that you'll see that I've got here is I've got all this metadata. And if I expand this, you'll see that there's a bunch of stuff here. Oops. It's a bunch of stuff here. So there's controller attribute. This is the action descriptor. There's data tokens, if you had data tokens on this route. And then there's a bunch of filters here. And this is all the metadata. You can think of that like the action descriptor. So we've effectively created like an action descriptor for anything. And I'm showing you with an MVC controller, but we could also do the same thing with something that is way more primitive. So I can add health checks in here. Now, if you haven't used health checks is a middleware that you can use to wire up a health endpoint for a monitoring service or a metrics dashboard or a alerting system or a container monitoring service or anything that you want to monitor your application. Now, and it's a middleware and it's very low level and it has basically no dependencies. Now, if I hit this health endpoint, you can see that I've got my health checks endpoint. And you can see that I've got the route that I defined for my health checks endpoint. And I'll basically gonna have no metadata, right? I basically have no metadata because there's not really anything there.
Right, okay.
There's nothing to say about it. It's just an endpoint. It's just a middleware. Now, what's cool about this is that I can do things with this that I've never been able to do before. Because all these things that plug in here are as good as an MVC action now in terms of how the system works. So I can say, I want authorization. And I'm just going to do the default policy, which is make me be logged in. I can also do this. I can say map get, and let's go foo. And I'm just going to run some delegate here. I could put some random delegate here. And I can put authorization on that now. It's as good as an MVC action.
Yeah.
So if I come here again and I do health, you're going to see me get bounced to the login page for the health checks endpoint. So let's do that real quick. So that's my index page. Let's do health. Right, so I'm right here. I think I am logged in, and that's why. So I got bounced to the login page, right? So that if we had looked at that endpoint, we would have seen that it's the login, or it's the endpoint for the login page would be the one that I'm seeing there, right? Now, how does this work? I've actually got another cool diagram. So this is a diagram of endpoint routing in action. And compare and contrast this with our 2.1 and earlier application, our 2.2 and earlier application. You've got this middleware pipeline where things happen, and then you've got MVC, and you've got MVC picking an action, and then you've got all this functionality that only happens inside of MVC. Let's compare this to our 2.2 application or 3.0 application, where you've got middleware pipeline, and then you've got routing happening here, and then you've got more middleware, and then you've got the actual thing running at the end. So the way to think about this is, going back to my code, this static files and everything up above here happen before routing. This is the thing that makes the decision. These are the things that get to see the endpoint, including my little helper here. And then this is the thing that actually executes the endpoint. So anything after here, I could put another middleware after here, would only run if nothing matched. Does that make sense? Am I blowing your mind, John?
This is making sense. People are saying this seems simpler in a lot of ways. Yeah. So good question in the chat. Frederick is saying, can you use endpoint routing to do URL-based localization?
Yes.
That's a great answer.
Yes. So remember, we have the localization middleware, and I think we ship a route value based plugin for that. So mm-hmm. let's do something else, because I didn't show this, but it's totally a thing, right? So let's do HTTP context dot features get I route values feature, I think it's called. Yes, correct. So another thing that you can do here, which is probably what he's wondering about, is let's do this. Because this seems to be what everybody wants to do with these things, right? Mm-hmm. So this is going to 404 because I've changed my route, and I would define other routes if I were doing this, right? So you can see that we've got no endpoint, right? Because right. We're still processing the pipeline, but nothing has matched, therefore nothing will happen. So I would say like en home index, right? And you can see I've got an endpoint now, and I've matched my home controller. But you can also see that I've got these route values. And this is the same, you know, this is the same route value dictionary that you're used to. And if you look at this guy, you'll see I've got my action controller and my language.
Right, okay.
So we have a localization middleware, and I believe this isn't part of the demo script, but it is interesting. believe we have an options type here or something. Localization options, right? And then on this, we have, I think, I'm pretty certain we have a route values provider for this. So there's a request culture providers, new route value. Anyway, some people have tried to do this before and it's never worked well, right? So I would include this as this is one of the scenarios that are things that I wanted to work really well with this. Authorization is the other thing that I really wanted to work well, because there's been no way to authorize arbitrary code. So we added health checks, and a lot of people said, great, how do I secure my health checks endpoint?
Yeah, yeah, because like, health checks can give away things.
We don't want to invent the universe to create authorization for health checks. What I've seen with this is there are some frameworks out there or some middleware out there that provide like these sort of diagnostics kind of things like health checks. And they end up defining their own security or their own sort of like routing systems within themselves, which is not something that we super want as sort of stewards of the platform. We'd prefer for everybody's default choice to be using the authorization system that ships with the framework, unless you've got some really strong reason not to use those abstractions. But we hadn't done the work to make it usable enough. So this is part of that. So hopefully this makes some things that we already have a lot more useful and a lot more sort of resonant, that makes sense.
Yeah, and not to derail too much, but one of the good questions Jim's asking, can you use endpoint routing to do version-based API endpoints?
Yeah.
So that's kind of like a standard routing feature you could use. So.
The answer is that you can use current routing to do version-based routing, right? So Chris Martinez, who's at Microsoft, has written a package that's pretty popular. It's branded as a Microsoft ASP.NET package, but it's not actually made by us. So it's like Microsoft ASP.NET Core MVC.versioning, I think it's called.
Right, right, I remember that.
He's a friend of mine, and we work together on this kind of stuff. So his versioning stuff works with old routing and new routing.
Cool.
And he was an earlier adopter of this. So I want to show one other thing that we're doing here. I don't know how we're doing on time. What's our...
Yeah, well, we should wrap in the next, say, 5 minutes.
Okay, let's wrap in the next 5 minutes. I want to blow everybody's...
And then we should definitely get you back on to go deeper into this, or, okay, you know, keep on with this.
I want to blow everybody's mind with one more thing. So something that we've done recently that I think will hopefully be really popular with people, because we should have had this for a long time now, is we now have a... Oh no, my route will be fine. We now have extensibility for the developer exception page. Which you're like, extensibility for the developer exception page. Why would I care about that? I hopefully am going to make you care about that. So what if you are somebody and you are testing an API and you are doing some API development? Do you test your API in a browser? What do you use to test your API? Do you use curl at the command line? Do you use Postman? Do you use... Fiddler? Or do you use the browser? Are you old school, right? Gee, it'd be nice if we could optimize the developer error exception scenario for the kinds of things that people use, either by making a different choice based on the kind of thing you're interacting with, or making a different choice based on the kind of client you are. So one of the things that we've done in 3.0 that I think is in preview 5, not preview 4, which is out now, but the next preview, which will be soon, is the ability to have the developer exception page return plain text if the client doesn't understand HTML. Now, what I've done here is I'm using some new extensibility that's part of the developer exception page, and I'm doing my own thing. And I'm showing off a little bit of the power of endpoints again. So I have written a developer page exception filter, which is the extensibility for the exception page. And what I'm doing is I'm saying, if the error came from an API controller, so what's the endpoint? We've talked about endpoints. If the endpoint has an API controller attribute, then I want to do JSON. So I'm going to write JSON. I'm going to serialize this object as JSON. So I'm, and again, this is developer exception page. It's only on in development, so we're okay, you know, sending this information over the wire. And this is that, right? This is that simple extensibility. So I'll refresh my, I'm just going to refresh my page here real quick. And you can see I've got, we'll step through. You can see I've got my endpoint. It's this throw action I wrote. If we look at the metadata, it's an MVC controller. So you can see I've got a bunch of filters here. I've got an HP method attribute, HP get attribute, and I've also got this API controller attribute. So I can write code that's specialized on like where this error came from, basically. And I can write it as JSON. And that's what you see here. Not showing the raw, this is the raw data.
Okay. And then I could go further with this if I have specific, if I'm using some weird format of my own or whatever, yeah. I could go into customizing my developer exception page stuff.
Yeah. So the other thing that kind of jumps out to me when I look at this code is, gee, it'd also be nice if I could use formatters here to write the JSON. It'd be nice if I didn't have to do this by hand, because we know that obviously not important in the case of a developer exception page, but converting this object into a string and then writing the string is about the least efficient way I could do this. Gee, it'd be nice if I could use the facilities that are provided by MVC to write my serialization code in a much more efficient way. So some other things that are kind of on the roadmap, and I'm just wrapping this up. The endpoint routing thing kind of has to come first, because it's at the heart of all these customizations and all these metadata driven systems. What do we want to do next? Well, we want to do things that make things more integrated sort of first, right? That's why we're talking about endpoint routing. That's why we're talking about auth. That's why we're talking about using localization in this kind of context. Other features that might be good to sort of flatten, some notion of formatters, the ability that you have a service that you can call to do JSON output or do XML output or do whatever you want. Some sort of general purpose model binding and validation. Let's take that out of MVC and let's make that a general purpose facility so that I could use it in a library, or I could use it in some more programming in the small. And something that a lot of people have asked for when they've seen endpoint routing is sort of like, okay, great. How do I make API Explorer, OpenAPI, Swagger aware of my health checks endpoint? Right now we have no system for interfacing like a Swagger interface with endpoints. It could be built, no one's built it. But maybe we do that, right? Maybe we help the existing Swagger libraries get on that train. So those are some thoughts about things we might do next. I mean, to me, these are in order for me personally of what I'd like to do. I think it's a story that goes over the next couple releases.
Very cool.
So, and I got to the end before we completely ran out of time or only ran over a little.
Well, wow, this is great stuff. And so this was, I mean, part of the idea here was to dig into some deeper like architecture things. And then like you've explained kind of the past and the kind of decision-making process and then future vision.
Yeah.
As people are watching, let us know what more you'd like to see. And we can make a series out of this if you'd like. So.
Yeah, I'd be happy.
Great. Okay. Well, we're definitely at time.
Okay.
So thank you so much. I appreciate your humoring me as I jumped in with questions as you're trying to get through.
No, it's great.
So cool.
Always a pleasure, John.
All right. Yep. All right. Well, thanks a bunch. Thanks everybody for sticking with us. Bye. Woo.